money into the coffers of Gloder's Nazi party. By now convinced that only he possessed the necessary combination of sophisticated statecraft and popular backing to lead Germany out of its spiralling economic crisis. By the fall of 1929, with hyperinflation rampant and unemployment reaching epidemic proportions, it was clear that, "Christ, Mikey, how much longer are you going to be?" I looked up, startled. "What time is it?" "Damn near 6 o'clock." "Hell, I've only just begun. Can I take these books away with me?" Steve shook his head. "Not the reference stuff, not the encyclopedias and all. They have to stay on site. Guess you can take out these, okay?" He went to the table and picked up 2 smaller books, textbooks on European history. "I'll take them then," I said, and stood and stretched. "Christ, I'm sorry. You must have been so bored, Steve. Why didn't you go? I reckon I know my way back to Henry Hall by now." Steve tucked the books under his arm. "I'll tag along," he said. "Honestly, you don't have to." He looked down at the carpet, embarrassed. "Fact is, Mikey..."
"What?"
"See, Professor Taylor, he told me not to let you out of my sight."
"Oh,"
I said. "Yes, I see. Thinks I'm dangerous, does he?" "Maybe he figures you might get lost, you know, get yourself into trouble, do yourself some more damage." I nodded. "Well, it's awful for you. I'm sorry. Hey, will you do me a favor? Will you stop apologizing all the time?" "It's an English habit," I said. "We've so much to be sorry for."
"Yeah, right."
As I opened the door into the corridor, Steve stopped.
"Gee, I just had a thought. Does it have to be books?"
"I'm sorry?"
"How about carts?"
"Carts?"
"Yeah, if you want to study history, you can take out carts."
"I don't want to sound stupid," I said, "but what the hell is a cart?"
10 minutes later, we were walking out of the Firestone building, 2 borrowable library books and a stack of carts under my arm.
"So," said Steve, "you're going to tell me what this is all about? This sudden need to know all about the Nazi party?"
"I wish I could tell you," I said, "but I know you'd just think I was mad."
Steve stopped and considered for a moment.
"Here's what we do. See that building over there? That's the Chancellor Green Student Center. We go in, we pick up some pizzas and some donuts and some soda and whatever stuff else we feel like, and we take it back to your place. Then you tell me everything that's in your mind. Deal?"
"Deal," I said. I was relieved to arrive back at Henry Hall. The sight of so many students in the rotunda at the student centre had unnerved me, reminded me of how adrift I was, how alienated. The particularities of foreign food, foreign ways of serving it, foreign money, foreign shouts and calls, foreign laughing, foreign smells and foreign looks, they had hemmed me in on all sides until I wanted to scream. My room in Henry Hall, so strange to me this morning, now took on all the comfort and familiarity of an old pair of docksiders. We dumped the brown paper bags of food onto the desk by the window. It was still light, but I wrestled with the blind rod until the slats closed and switched on a lamp. There was a feeling I had, a hunted feeling, a need to nest down. As we champed on our wedges of pizza, I looked up at the walls. "These people here," I said, pointing to a poster. "Who the hell are they?"
"You're kidding?"
"No, really, tell me."
"They are the New York Yankees, Mike. You take a train to Penn Station to watch them play most every time you can."
"Oh, and them?"
"Mandrax."
"Mandrax," I repeated. "They're a band, right?"
"They're a band.
And I like them, do I?"
Steve nodded with a smile.
"They look like the saddest load of old farts I've ever seen," I said. "Are you sure I like them?"
"Sure," he nodded. "They're neat."
"Neat, are they? Well, if they're neat, I must be crazy about them. I happen to love neat. How about the Beatles? Do I like them? The Rolling Stones? Led Zeppelin? Elton John? Blur?
Oily Moily? Oasis?
I laughed with pleasure at his blank stare.
Christ, I'm going to make a killing, I giggled.
Here, listen to this.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
What do you reckon?
Ouch, said Steve, his hand over his ears.
You have to hear the harmonies, I suppose.
How about this, then? Imagine there's no heaven.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. I'll need some time alone with a synthesizer.
I stood and walked around the walls.
Who's this, then?
Luke White.
He's a singer?
Get out of here. He's a movie star.
Rather cute, isn't he? Why have I got him up on my wall?
That's what a lot of people would like to know, Steve said, and then turned a furious shade of red.
As he tried to cover up his confusion by concentrating on the interior of a doughnut, a thought that I'd been carrying at the back of my mind forced itself upon me.
Steve, this is going to sound like a really stupid question, but I'm not gay, am I?
Steve frowned.
Gay? Sometimes, I guess.
Sure.
No, you misunderstand me. Am I, am I a fairy, queer?
Steve went absolutely white.
Fuck's sake, Mikey. Well, it isn't so strange a question, is it? I mean, you said I didn't have any girlfriends, and then I thought, well, these posters, I just, wondered, that's all.
Jesus, man, are you crazy?
Well, I know I never used to be in my memory, that is. At least I don't think I was, particularly. Any more than normal. I had a girlfriend, but frankly it was a pretty weird relationship in some ways. She was older than me, and it was as much convenience as anything, sharing a house, that sort of thing. I mean, I loved her and everything, but I often used to envy James and Double Eddie slightly. Perhaps all the time I was... Hell, I just wondered, I expect it's normal, no big deal.
Steve was staring at his Coke can as if it held the secret of life.
No big deal, he said unsteadily. You shouldn't talk like that, Mikey. You'll go getting yourself into trouble.
Into trouble? You talk about it as if it's a crime. I mean, all I'm asking is, am I now or have I ever been?
Oh, my God.
I broke off abruptly, the rhythms of that old McCarthyite mantra causing a sudden terrible understanding to dawn.
It is, isn't it? It's a crime.
He turned to me and I could almost believe that there were tears in his eyes.
Of course it's a fucking crime, you asshole. Where the hell have you been living?
Well, that's just it, Steve, I said. That's just it. You see, where I come from, it isn't a crime.
Oh, right, sure, like on Mars, in the valley of the Big Rock Candy Mountain, where marshmallows grow on the candy cane trees and everybody skips and jumps and bakes cherry pie for strangers.
I couldn't think of anything else to say.
Steve finished the Coke, pressed the sides of the can in with his thumbs and fumbled for a cigarette.
I lit one too and cleared my throat, hating the silence.
I assume that we've never... That is, the two of us?
He glared at me furiously.
I'll take that as a no, then.
He leaned forward in his chair and looked down between his legs at the carpet, his hair flopping straight down and obscuring his face.
Once more, silence reigned.
Look, Steve, I said, if I told you that I did come from Mars... You'd think I was mad, wouldn't you? But suppose I came from another place, just as strange, from a culture quite different from your own.
Steve said nothing, just continued to scrutinize the carpet.
You're a rational man, I went on. You must concede that what has apparently happened to me is hard to explain. The way I talk, it's not put on, you know that. Even Professor Taylor saw it, and he's genuinely English. Well, genuinely over-English, frankly. You've seen me change in a second,
One sudden nanosecond against a wall in Palmer Square, change from the guy you knew, all-American, philosophy-majoring, baseball-pitching, tooth-flossing, regular old Mikey Young, into someone completely different. I'm not different on the outside, but on the inside, I am. You can't deny that. It's as plain as the hair on your head, which for some reason is all I can see of you at the moment. I know thousands of things I never knew before, but thousands of things I should know, I don't. I don't know who's President of the United States. I don't know where Hartford, Connecticut is. I'm not even sure where Connecticut itself is, come to that. Somewhere on the right-hand side, that's all I'm sure of. I had never seen this campus before in my life until this morning. You know I wasn't faking that. But I can tell you things about European history before 1920... that I couldn't possibly know unless I'd studied it deeply. Here, I'll prove it. Take this book and ask me any fact, anything. Steve took the proffered book doubtfully. So maybe you know stuff about Europe. So what? You know me pretty well. You think you know me pretty well. Look around you at my bookshelves. Not one single history book. Did I do any history in my first 2 years? Take any courses in it? Guess not. Right, so test me. Anything from before 1930, say. Steve flipped through the book and stopped at a page. OK, then, what was the Holy Alliance? I smiled. Sir, please, sir, easy peasy, sir, I said, shooting my hand up in the air. The Holy Alliance was the name given to a compact, sir, a compact signed by the extremely unholy trinity of... Let me see, the Tsar of Russia, that would have been Alexander the First, and by Friedrich Wilhelm the Third of Prussia, and by the Holy Roman Emperor Francis the Second, though of course he was just plain old Francis the First of Austria now, wasn't he? What with Napoleon's arse being whipped at Waterloo and all. Who else signed it? Steve was studying the book carefully. Well, sir, Naples, sir, Sardinia, sir, France and Spain, sir. It was subsequently signed and ratified by Britain, the Prince Regent, later George IV, his father being Potty at the time, of course, though Britain was part of the Quadruple Alliance, which was quite different, and the Ottoman Sultan signed it too. Though I'm afraid to say I can't remember his name, if I ever knew it. And, of course, the Pope blessed it with a great blessing. The compact was signed in 1815. For an extra 10 points and the holiday in Barbados, I would go for 26th September. Am I right? Okay, okay. Steve rifled through the book again. How about Benjamin Disraeli? Benjamin Disraeli? What can't I tell you? I was just humming now, in my element, skating elegantly on thick ice. Born 1804, 21st. December, I think, coined the phrase the greasy pole to describe his rise from humble Jewish origins to the prime ministership of high Victorian England and Empire. Son of a Sephardic dilettante, writer, antiquarian and sweetie by the name of Isaac, who converted his whole family to Christianity in 1817. Ben started off as a law apprentice, dropped a bundle on bad investments, and so turned himself into a novelist and wit to fund his dandy lifestyle and political aspirations. Wrote a series of books known as the Young England novels, notably Coningsby or The Younger Generation, and Sybil or The Two Nations. He'd been first elected to Parliament a few years earlier, around about 1837, I think, his fifth attempt at a seat. Anti-Whig, anti-utilitarian, he made a name for himself attacking his own government. He coined the phrase organised hypocrisy to describe Robert Peel's attempts to repeal the Corn Laws. Hung around for years after that as leader of the party, Chancellor of the Exchequer under Lord Derby, framing the Second Reform Act of 1860, which extended the vote to borough householders. Briefly became Prime Minister in 1868, finally won an election against his great rival William Ewart Gladstone in 1874, first Conservative win since 1841. Shoved through a load of trade union and social reforms, borrowed £4 million to purchase the Suez Canal for Queen Victoria, who was crazy about him, especially after he gave her the official new title Empress of India. He returned from the Congress of Berlin in 1878, claiming peace with honour, not unlike Chamberlain after Munich, though that won't be in your book, I'm afraid. Was created the first Earl of Beaconsfield in 1876, having turned down a dukedom earlier, died in 1881 after being booted out of office the previous year. 19th
April was the day he died, 8 years and a day before the birth of Adolf Hitler, of whom you've also never heard. His followers call themselves the Primrose League and to this day go on about one nation conservatism. His wife called him Dizzy, and she was famous for her devotion, lack of tact and general goofiness. Once travelled with him in a carriage to Parliament with her fingers jammed in the door in agony and never told him because she didn't want to put him off his preparations for a big speech. Another time she was in a garden with a couple of Victorian ladies and they tittered blushingly at a naked male statue's generous endowment. "Oh, that's nothing," she said. "You should see my Dizzy when he's in the bath." He described his final years as being his anecdotage. What else do you want to know? Steve didn't look up from the book. Give me the titles of some of his other novels. Phew, don't want much, do you? Well, his first was called something like Dorian Gray. Obviously not that, but something like it. Vivian Gray, was that it? There was another called The Young Duke. His last was Endymion, I know that. Wrote it in 1880. And I'm pretty sure there was another one with a woman's name in the title. Henrietta, I think. Henrietta Tempest, something like that. Henrietta Temple, actually, said Steve, closing the book. OK, so you know some history. What does that mean? You tell me, I said. Does it square with what you know of me? Let me tell you every American president this century. Oh, like, big deal. Every school kid of 10 can do that. Listen, I said. William McKinley, assassinated 1901. Teddy Roosevelt. William Howard Taft. Woodrow Wilson, Warren G. Harding, Calvin Coolidge, Herbert C. Hoover, FDR, 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 Harry S. Truman, Dwight D. Eisenhower, Eisenhower again, John F. Kennedy, assassinated 63, Lyndon B. Johnson, Richard M. Nixon, Nixon again, resigned 74, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, Reagan again, George Bush, and finally, ladies and gentlemen, the 42nd president of these United States, Bill Clinton of Little Rock, Arkansas. How's that? There was a puzzled look on Steve's face. I kind of got lost somewhere in the middle. Of course you did. After FDR, right? Right. There was a whole load of names there I never heard before. And you said Nixon resigned? So you've heard of Nixon, then? Oh, come on, Mikey. Get real. Richard Milhouse Nixon, Tricky Dicky, resigned in disgrace to avoid impeachment in 1973. For your information, Richard Nixon was president three times, from 1960 to 1972. I see. But Kennedy, Carter, Bush, LBJ, Clinton, they mean nothing to you? My little brother is called Clinton, but he sure as hell isn't president. There, you see? I lit another cigarette and started to pace up and down. Everything you know is different from what I know. How can that be? Your accent is different than it was yesterday. Some ways you're a different person than you were. I see that. But, Mikey, it's your head. It's all in your head. Oh, and a crack to the skull gave me a scholar's knowledge of European history, did it? It gave me the details of American presidents you've never heard of and about whom I could talk in front of a lie detector for 2 hours without causing the needle to tremble once. It filled my mind with movies and songs and stories you've never heard before. Play it again, Sam. I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. The Force may be with you, young Skywalker, but you are not a Jedi yet. I love the smell of napalm in the morning. The truth is out there. Hasta la vista, baby. Catch 22. There will be no whitewash at the White House. The Tin Drum, What's the Story, Morning Glory, Schindler's List. The name's Bond, James Bond. Ich bin ein Berliner, Catcher in the Rye. You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. Perhaps someday you'll join me, and the world will live as one. Beam me up, Scotty. I shall return. Sing if you're glad to be gay, sing if you're happy that way. Tinker, tailor, soldier, spy. Never in the field of human conflict has so much been owed by so many to so few.
One small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. From here to eternity, never mind the bollocks, here's the Sex Pistols. The bridge on the River Kwai, Marlene Dietrich, E.T. phone home. What good is sitting alone in a room? Come, hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old friend, it's only a cabaret. The Zapruder film and the grassy knoll, the Dirty Dozen. It's coming home, it's coming home, it's coming. Football's coming home, where eagles dare. I smoked it, but I didn't inhale. Where's the beef? Read my lips, no new taxes. Scooby-dooby-doo, where are you? We've got some work for you now. There.
I paused for breath, sweating from the combination of effort, exhilaration and hot pepperoni. On Steve's face, I saw an expression in which admiration, astonishment, amusement, bafflement and fear were racing for the lead. Astonishment was ahead by half a length, but the others were pressing hard.
Face up to it, Steve. I'm giving you a problem here that you can't solve by talking about bumps and amnesia. I come from somewhere else.
I ruffled my hair to allow air to pass through and cool the sweat.
Don't think I don't know how mad I'm sounding. God knows, I've seen enough movies to know how hard it is for the alien time-travelling hero to persuade anyone to listen to him. They usually end up by turning him in.
Time travel? Steve closed his eyes tight in despair.
Oh, Jesus, Mikey, you need help. You can't be... That's not what I meant. Let me call Doc Ballinger. He pleaded. Mikey, I don't know what's happening, but I care about you. I mean, I care about what happens to you. I don't want you to go nuts.
I know what you mean, Steve, but please, just listen. That's not what I'm saying. I haven't travelled in time. That is, not exactly. It's just that time has travelled in me. No, that's not right. Listen to me, will you? Just listen. I'll tell you a story. Imagine it's just an idea, OK? A plot for a movie, something like that. Hear it with open ears. What's the phrase? Without prejudice. Hear it without prejudice. Interrupt only if something is unclear. And when you've heard it, then you can decide what to do. Deal?
I guess so.
I moved the books and carts to one side of the desk and hauled myself onto it, swinging my legs below me. Steve sat on the floor, tailor fashion, looking up at me like a toddler on the playmat at story time.
"Okay," I said. "Imagine a guy, a youngish guy, English. He's about my age. He's researching for a history doctorate in an English university town. Let's call it Cambridge."
Time passes. The sun sinks slowly in the west. Sounds penetrate the room. Basketballs slapping on the corridor floor, the squeal of skidding trainers, bluegrass music playing in the room above, doors slamming, shouts, the flicking of towels on flesh, a badly tuned guitar across the hall, distant bells chiming the hours that slip past unheeded. A pizza, some Coke, and some absolutely disgusting jam donuts, and came back to this dorm building, this Henry Hall. There, he decided to tell his new friend Steve everything that had happened, telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help him God. The end. I stood from the desk and stretched. Darkness had fallen outside, and within Henry Hall, silence reigned. Steve stayed down on the floor. His only movement was to lean forward from time to time and flick the end of the cigarette into the cola can, which was now so full of butts and sludge that it had long since ceased to fizz at each new fall of hot ash.
"What I don't understand," he said at last, "is how come, if this is all true, how come you can remember about it?"
"Exactly," I said. "That's what beats me, too," I said. "I mean, if my body is out here, then why is my consciousness still part of the old world?"
"I guess," said Steve slowly, I guess if this guy Zuckerman was generating an artificial quantum singularity and you got caught in the event horizon, then maybe... I don't know. He shrugged helplessly. Heck, Mikey, nothing you've said means anything to me. But you do believe me. You do, don't you? He spread his hands. I can't think of a better explanation for the way you've been behaving, but in theory, this could happen all the time, you know? Maybe it's happened many times before. We'd never know it. Maybe there's 1,000 20th centuries, 1,000,000, all with different outcomes. You generated one of your own, and you're stuck in it. That's it, I said. But in my arrogance, I thought I'd generated a better one. I thought if Hitler wasn't born, the century would have less to be ashamed of. I suppose I should have known better. The circumstances were still the same in Europe. There was still a vacuum in Germany waiting to be filled. There were still 50 years of anti-Semitism and nationalism ready to be exploited. There was still a Versailles Treaty and a Wall Street crash and a Great Depression. But one thing at least.
What?
Well, this Rudolf Gloder, this Führer, I mean, at least he wasn't as bad as Hitler. From what I could tell of him from that book, he was human at least, sane. I mean, there weren't any death camps, no Zyklon B, no Holocaust, no frothing monomania, no genocide.
Steve stood slowly, easing the cramp in his legs.
Oh, Mikey, he said sorrowfully. Oh, Mikey, you don't know what you're saying. I stared at him.
What do you mean?
This Hitler of yours, what happened to him?
He committed suicide, as the Russians were pressing in on Berlin on one side and the Americans and British on the other. Shot himself and was burned in petrol in the garden of the Reich Chancellery, 30th of April, 1945.
I think maybe, said Steve, going over to the computer, that it's time you had a look at some of these carts.
He picked one up from the pile we had collected at the library, a small square box, about 3 inches by 4 and half an inch thick. He pulled at the casing and removed a smaller square of black plastic.
Why can't you tell me what it is you want me to know?
Unlike you, said Steve, pushing the black square into a slit below the computer's monitor, I'm no history scholar.
So this is what, some sort of video then? Or is it like a CD-ROM?
It's not like anything, said Steve. It's a cart. It's just a cart.
I looked around the desk with a helpless air. And where's the keyboard?
Steve shook his head.
Heck, Mikey, what do you think this is, a frigging piano?
He flicked a switch on the monitor and the screen lit up in orange and black.
You want to watch from the beginning?
He tossed me the cart's casing. I looked at its title, printed in thick black German Gothic above a huge flaming swastika.
The Fall of Europe.
Oh, shit, I said, filled with bowel-dropping dread.
Yes, from the beginning.
Steve put his finger on the surface of the TV and a menu flashed up, blue lettering in big block squares. He touched the first square. A faint spinning noise came from the interior of the computer, and almost immediately an orchestral fanfare blasted from speakers in the corners of the room. Steve dived towards a fader switch, and the volume dropped. Not before the wall was thumped and a bleary shout had told us to keep the frigging noise down. Steve handed me some earphones and guided my hands to the volume fader.
"Donaldson and Webb, World History Series," a voice proclaimed, as if announcing a heavyweight title bout. "The Fall of Europe."
The menu faded to a title screen in the same Gothic lettering. I dropped down into the chair in front of the monitor. The film, and it was a kind of film, marginally interactive, allowing me to pause and access little side boxes of information using my finger on the screen, seemed to me to be aimed more at schools than at an Ivy League major, but it was just what I needed. Just what I didn't need.
Here, said Steve, this goes with it.
The clear plastic casing of the cart holder contained a shiny printed cover, like the cover of a CD album.
Steve pulled it out and gave it to me, and from time to time I referred to this leaflet as I watched. Donaldson and Webb Educational Media Cartridges, Series 3, World History, Part 5, The Fall of Europe, Search Index, Track 1, May 1932, The Nazi Party Elected to the Reichstag, Versailles Treaty Renegotiated with Britain, France and America, Pact with Stalin. Track 2, 1933-34, Launch of Deutschwagen Rotary-Engined Automobile, Development of Miniature Evacuated Tube Components, Transforms Burgeoning German Electronics Industry. Track 3, 1935-36, Edinburgh Agreement Ensures Mutual Trade Arrangements Between British Empire and the New Reich, Licensing of German technological developments in return for British rubber concessions and use of eastern trade routes. Berlin Olympics, attended by President Roosevelt and King George V. Track 4, 1937. German-wide social welfare and national insurance scheme launched. Austria and Germany united. Glöder awarded Nobel Peace Prize. Addresses League of Nations on the modern state. Track 5, 1938, Part 1. Fourth Nazi Congress. Shock announcement by Glöder of development at Göttingen Institute of weaponry harnessing power of the atom. Paris Conference boycotted by Germany. Detonation of atomic bombs devastates Moscow and Leningrad, killing Stalin and entire Politburo. German invasion of Soviet Union. Annexation of Poland, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Hungary, Greece, Turkey and the Baltic states. Track 6, 1938, Part 2. Capitulation of Scandinavia, Benelux, France and the United Kingdom. First Greater German Reich Conference in Berlin, attended by King Edward VIII of Great Britain, Marshal Pétain, Benito Mussolini, Generalissimo Franco and other heads of state. Terms of cooperation agreed with United States of America. Mutual agreement brokered by Germany to divide Pacific control between America and Imperial Japan. British possessions in India, Australia and Africa effectively under German control. Canada allowed to remain neutral. Track 7, 1939. All Jews forced to evacuate countries under the control of Greater German Reich and emigrate to new Jewish Free State in area carved out between Montenegro and Herzegovina under control of Reich Minister Heydrich. American protests ignored. Rebellion in Britain quashed, over 5,000 executed, including leading politicians and the Duke of York, brother of British King. Track 8, 1940-41. United States announces separate development of atom bomb. State of Cold War between Greater Germany and America. All diplomatic contacts closed. Track 9, 1942. Rumors of ill treatment and mass murder of citizens of Balkan Jewish Free State bring America to the brink of nuclear war with Greater Germany. Announcements of innovations in German rocketry and electronic telemetry cause United States government to back down. Rebellion in Russia ruthlessly crushed. Track 10, 1943. Unified system of education imposed across new Europe. German to become first language of all Europeans. Discovery by Berlin government of secret American supplies to resistance movement in Portugal brings new threat of war between the United States and Germany. Track 11. Credits, copyright notice, course notes, suggested reading. I watched the whole cart, Steve told me afterwards, with my mouth open. It seems my attitude never shifted, my hands never moved, my legs never crossed or uncrossed, my shoulder never dropped. It was as if, he said, I was in a state of near catalepsy. Only the movement of my eyes between the screen and the printed search index in my hands betrayed any sign of life or consciousness. When it had finished, Steve leaned forward, flicked a switch on the computer, and put a hand on my shoulder. I stared into the screen's grey emptiness as the cart slid from its drive. Oh, Christ, I said in a kind of whimper. What have I done? What have I done? Hey, don't worry, said Steve, massaging my shoulders. It's history. It's all history. Steve, what happened to the Jews? This Jewish free state? Does it still exist? Look, that was years ago. Things have changed now. America and Europe are on pretty good terms. Europe even has free elections. More or less free. You haven't answered my question. The Jews, what about them?
There aren't any. Not in Europe.
You mean they were moved to Israel? What happened? A sudden loud knock on the door caused Steve to whip his hand away from my shoulder and leap back to the centre of the room. In answer to my raised eyebrows, he shook his head, as puzzled as me, as to who the hell might be calling on me at 1 o'clock in the morning. The knock came again, louder this time. "Come in," I said. Two men entered the room. They both wore the same checked short-sleeved shirts I had seen earlier in the day when Steve and I had sat at a table next to them in the outside courtyard of the alchemist and barrister while they bickered over maps.
Natural History. Still waters run deep. "Find me a map of the area," said Kramer. "A geological map, the latest." Bauer scribbled on a request form, which he packed into a small brass torpedo. Going over to the wall, he asked Kramer how late he imagined they would be working that evening. Kramer, hunched over the microscope, said nothing. Bauer slipped the torpedo into the communication tube. He smacked the cap closed and listened as the torpedo was sucked away and clattered down the pipework on its journey to the first floor typing pool. He looked at his watch. 5:34. Hartmann, head of documents, maintained that any document in the university could be retrieved and delivered within 15 minutes. He had promised to buy Bauer a whole litre of Berliner white beer if he failed to live up to this proud boast by so much as a second. This should be a good test, and on such a sultry August day, a large beer, maybe with a shot of raspberry, would be welcome. "Ruth, a moment," he said, beckoning his assistant. "Would you perhaps be so kind as to telephone my wife and tell her that I would be late home again this evening?" Ruth nodded and moved stiffly to the telephone. She did not take kindly to being treated as a secretary. Bauer returned to his part of the bench and began to sort idly and hopelessly through his papers. Kramer looked up from the microscope, snapping his fingers. "Well, where is it?" he said. "The map. Oh, good God, Johann. Give them a chance. You only asked me a minute ago." "What? Really?" "Yes. I'm sorry." Kramer smiled across at him like a rueful schoolboy. "Still, I do wish they would hurry up." "Have you seen something?" Kramer pinched the bridge of his nose wearily, his eyes closed. "No, nothing." "You were examining the zinc and sodium levels." "Yes, but it's nothing. Higher than average, but lower than our own supply here. We should be looking for something bigger, something much bigger." "What about those traces of methyl orange?" "It's contamination, it must be. That original doctor, I assume. What was his name?" "Schenk. Horst Schenk." "Yes, him. The whole thing is insane, Dietrich. If I hadn't seen it work on our mice, I would believe it was all a hoax." Kramer turned back to his microscope with a sigh. "Dr. Bauer." Ruth held out the telephone towards him, as if it were contaminated with anthrax. "Your wife asks that you come and say goodnight to your son." Bauer took the telephone and listened for a while in affectionate amusement to the quick breathing of his child. "Axie," he said at last. "Papa." "Have you been a good boy today?" "Papa." "I shall see you tomorrow." "Milk." "Did you say milk? You want some milk?" "Milk." "Mutti will give you milk. I can't give you milk over the telephone, you know. Ask Mutti for some milk." There followed more quick breathing and then a longer silence. Axel? Are you there? Fox. Fox? Fox, 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 fox. Well, that's nice. Bauer heard a clatter as the telephone was dropped. After another silence, Marta's voice echoed in his ear. Hello, darling. We saw a fox today, in the garden. It's his favourite animal now. Ah, oh, that explains it. I think he's got earache again. He says naughty ear and bangs the side of his head with the palm of his hand. I'm sure it's nothing serious. I'll take a look tomorrow morning. How late are you going to be? That Jew student of yours wouldn't tell me. I'm sorry, darling, but what I'm working on, it's very important. Top priority. I understand, I do. But you will try and eat tonight, won't you? Of course. We're very well looked after here, you know. I know. The Fuhrer's favourites. Goodbye, darling. Bauer replaced the receiver. Ruth was standing awkwardly in the middle of the room, looking busily at a clipboard to show that she hadn't been listening. I think you might as well go home, Fräulein Goldmann. Professor Kramer and I can manage without you for the rest of the day. I'm very happy to stay, sir. No, no, please. No need. On her way out, Ruth almost collided with a breathless messenger from Retrievals. A glance at his watch told Bauer that he would have to buy his own beer again this evening. Nothing, said Kramer disgustedly. Absolutely nothing. The most topographically boring, geologically undistinguished and minerally commonplace terrain in the whole wide world. Not even especially pretty, agreed Bauer. For Austria, that is. Then what is going on? What in deepest hell is going on? Kramer hammered his pipe stem onto the map. It simply makes no sense. No sense at all. Maybe, said Bauer hesitantly, maybe we have missed something obvious. You always taught me that every centimetre one moves from an erroneous first principle takes one a kilometre further from the truth. Maybe we are going in entirely the wrong direction. Kramer looked up from the map. Explain. We are searching desperately for the cause of an effect that we do not understand. Perhaps it is the effect itself we should be examining. Kramer looked at him steadily. Perhaps, he said slowly, drawing out the word with reluctance. But, Dietrich, we are down to 30 centilitres. The stakes are so high, the pressure from Berlin so intense, we cannot afford the luxury of a blind alley. That is the point I'm making, Johann. A blind alley is where we are. Let us go back. Let us go back to the beginning. Bauer stretched out a hand to the shelf above the bench and pulled out the file marked Bruno.
American History. The Gettysburg Address. So, tell me, Mike, what do you know about Brunau? The voice was warm, interested, and impressed, as if the speaker were asking me to do a trick to impress a friend. I wondered what had happened to Steve. The speed and assurance of the two men, they had given their names as Hubbard and Brown, had left no time for questions or complaints. Would we follow them to their car, please? It was right outside. There were some questions that I could help them with. It would be so useful. No need to bring anything, and of course no need to worry. I'd been placed between Hubbard and Brown in the back seat of the first of the two long black sedans parked outside the doorway of Henry Hall, and it was only as we moved off that it had occurred to me that Steve was nowhere to be seen. I shifted round to give myself a view through the rear window to see if he was in the second car, but Brown, like an Edwardian schoolmaster, twisted my head gently but firmly back round to face the front. We had travelled no more than 20 minutes before we turned off the road and into the driveway of a large house. As we got out of the car, I could make out the clapboard of the gables, clinker built, like the background of that painting American Gothic. The air was soft and fragrant with the smell of pine trees. Inside, I was led through to a dining room and shown a seat in the middle of a large, shining maplewood table. Hubbard sat opposite me, and Brown stood at one end, fiddling with a coffee pot whose lid appeared to be stuck. "Consarn thing," he said, exasperatedly thumping the side of the lid with the side of his fist. "Charles Wininger," I exclaimed excitedly, then instantly wished that I had held my tongue. Hubbard leaned forward with interest. "Excuse me?" "It's nothing," I said. "I was just thinking aloud." "No, no, please." Hubbard spread his hands, inviting me. "I was thinking of Destry Rides Again. Charles Wininger plays a character called Wash Dimmesdale, and he's always saying, 'Consarn this' and 'Consarn that.' I never heard anyone else use the word before, that's all." Hubbard looked up at Brown, who shrugged and shook his head. "It's a movie," I explained. "At least it was once, but you've probably never heard of it." I saw that Hubbard had written down in a notebook the words Destry and Wininger, followed by two large question marks. I suppressed a desire to correct the spelling and stared down at the table, which glowed as if new. There was a quality to it, however, which suggested to me that it was not new, just very, very underused. "But you didn't answer my original question, did you, Mike? Brunau. Tell me what you know about Brunau." "What makes you think I know anything at all about it?" "You don't? Never heard of the place," I said. "Well, now, that's a start, Mikey. You know it's a place. You know it isn't a person or a shade of pink. That's a good start." "Pants. Fell into that one, didn't I? I suppose I must have heard of it somewhere, in a geography lesson, at school, maybe." I tried, fumblingly, to correct the sentence into something more American. "I mean, I guess I heard it in geography class, you know, in school sometime. I guess so, anyways." I winced inwardly at that last word, overdoing it a tad. Hubbard didn't seem to notice anything wrong, just continued with his gentle probing. "That right? So you remember where it is, this Brunau?" "Germany." "Good. You're doing good, Mike." "Hey, you want your coffee black or with cream?" Cream, please," I said, looking up from the table for the first time. Brown had unstuck the lid of the coffee pot somehow and was now delicately pouring thick black coffee into tiny little cups. There was an awkward pause as the social embarrassment of the handing round of sugar and teaspoons was completed. "Where's Steve?" I asked, looking around the room. "Is he here?" "He's around," said Hubbard, taking an exploratory sip of coffee. "Can I see him?" "Great coffee, Don." Brown nodded contentedly, as if he was used to receiving compliments on the quality of his brew. "I'd rather not talk any more until I've seen him, found out what this is all about."
"This is about you, me, and Mr. Brown here, having a little powwow, Mike. That's all. Nothing to worry about. You were telling us that you thought maybe Brunau was in Germany."
"Well, it sounds like a German name, doesn't it?"
"Let's try you on the name Hitler, shall we? That mean anything to you? Hitler?"
Maybe my pupils dilated. Maybe they shrank. Maybe I caught my breath a fraction. Maybe my colour changed. I know that I tried to sound casual, and I know that the attempt failed.
"Hitler?"
I said, swallowing.
"Where's that?"
Hubbard looked up again at Brown, who nodded and took a small chromium box from his breast pocket. Placing the box carefully on the table between me and Hubbard, Brown returned to his standing position at the end of the table, placing his hands behind his back like an acolyte who has just performed a ceremonial ritual of great importance. I stared at the box as if expecting it to speak. Which was smart of me, as a matter of fact, because after Hubbard had pressed a switch on its side, that was exactly what it did do. There was background noise, the rustling of cellophane, the clink of glasses, the splutter of a match, the distant rush of traffic and other extraneous alfresco sounds, but essentially the box spoke. This is what it said, in two voices, mine and Steve's. Me. You'll think I'm mad, I know, but I'm supremely happy at the moment. Steve. Yeah? How come? Me. You wouldn't understand if I told you. Steve. Try me. Me. I'm happy because when I asked you earlier, you told me that you'd never heard of Adolf Hitler. Steve. That made you happy? Me. You can have no idea what that means. You've never heard the names Hitler or Schicklgruber or Pölzl. You've never heard of Brunau. You've never... Steve. Brunau? Me. Brunau am Inn, Upper Austria. It's not even a name to you, and that makes me the happiest man alive. Steve. Well, that's Jake for you. Me. You've never heard of Auschwitz or Dachau. You've never heard of the Nazi Party. You've never heard of... Hubbard flicked the switch once more. So now we're getting somewhere. Brunau is not in Germany. It's in a region of Germany. It's in Austria. Upper Austria, even. That kind of narrows it down a little, don't you think? If you knew all the time that I knew where Brunau was... I said, why did you string me along? Well, now I guess I could put that question another way, Mikey. If you knew where Brunau was all the time, why did you string us along? Then that's stalemate, isn't it? I said. Hubbard looked into my eyes. I looked back into his, and in the restful chocolate brown of them, I tried to see what motive and what intent might be lying there. And Hitler, he said. You know that Hitler isn't a place. You know that it's a man's name. Adolf Hitler, you said. Who might Adolf Hitler be? I shook my head. And how about Auschwitz? What's that? A place? A person? A brand of beer? I shrugged. You tell me. The look of sadness in Hubbard's eyes intensified. That's not a good answer, Mikey, he said. That's a terrible answer. We want you to help us. We want you to tell us what you know. That's what this is about. It's not about you trying to be smart. And what we want to know, Brown's harsher voice added from the end of the table, is just who in tarnation you really are. My heart had started to hammer heavily in my chest. But you know who I am. I'm Michael Young. You know that? Do we know that, Mikey? Hubbard's voice was speculative, like that of an academic reflecting on the meaning of meaning. Do we really? We know that you look like Michael Young, but we know that you sure as shooting don't sound like him. We know that you sure as shooting don't behave like him. So can we know, you know? Really know? Why don't you take my fingerprints? That should satisfy you. We did that already, said Hubbard. And? You must know the answer to that, Hubbard said gently, or you wouldn't have raised the issue in the first place now, would you? So what then? You think I've had a skin graft? You think I'm some sort of clone? What? Hubbard gave no answer, but opened a small notebook and went carefully through the pages. How'd you make out with Professor Taylor? He asked. Make out with him? I don't know what you mean. Like you, he asked me a lot of questions. He told me not to worry. He told me I should have some tests. Why do you think Professor Taylor is over here? I'm sorry? An Englishman in America? That's a strange thing. What do you figure he's doing here? I thought about this for a while. He's a defector, I suggested, a European dissident, something like that. A defector. Hubbard tried the word out. And how about you?
you were European defector too?
I'm not European.
You talk like a European, Mikey. Your parents are European.
I lowered my head in exasperation.
What are you suggesting, that I'm a spy?
You tell us.
I looked at them both in astonishment. Are you serious? I mean, what kind of spy would go to all the trouble of disguising himself perfectly as an all-American student, right down to the fingerprints, and then go around the place talking loudly in an English accent?
Maybe the kind of spy who doesn't know he's a spy, said Brown.
What's that supposed to mean?
It doesn't mean anything, said Hubbard, frowning slightly at Brown.
Look, I said, if you've spoken to Steve, and you've spoken to Professor Taylor, and to Dr. Ballinger, and to anyone else, you'll know that I banged my head on a wall last night, and that I haven't been the same since. That's all there is to it. Bit of memory loss, speech gone funny. It's weird, but that's all it is. Weird.
Then how come, Mikey, said Hubbard, how come these names Hitler and Auschwitz and Pertzel and Brunau am Inn?
I must have heard them somewhere in my subconscious, and for some reason the bang on the head brought them to the surface of my mind. I mean, what's so bloody important about them? They don't mean anything, do they? They aren't of any significance. No one else seems to have heard of them.
That's right, Mikey. Outside of this room, I shouldn't think there's more than 12 people in the whole United States of America who ever heard those names in all their lives.
I had never heard them myself until you mentioned them to Steve in the courtyard of that cozy little bar off Witherspoon Street this afternoon. But you know, when we played the recording back to some friends of ours in Washington, they damn near pooped their pants. Can you believe that? Damn near pooped their $100 pants.
But why? I ran my fingers through my hair in bewilderment.
I don't understand why the names should mean anything at all.
Hubbard pricked his ears up at the sound of a car in the driveway.
Excuse me, Mike, I'll be right back, he said, rising. He left the room with a nod to Brown, closing the door behind him, and a few moments later I heard the front door open and the low murmur of voices in the hallway.
Alone with Brown, who seemed disinclined to talk, I tried to work out what was going on. Professor Taylor. It must have something to do with him. If Europe and the United States were in a state of cold war, as from everything I had learned that night they appeared to be, then Taylor might well be some kind of pro-American dissident, a sort of Solzhenitsyn or Gordievsky equivalent, who had at some time managed to defect to the United States. Maybe from time to time he fed tidbits to the CIA or whatever organization it was that Hubbard and Brown worked for. Maybe Taylor had heard about this strange undergraduate student who had suddenly started talking like an Englishman, and maybe he felt suspicious enough, after interviewing him personally, to recommend to his masters in Washington that this Michael Young be monitored and followed up. Yet how was it possible that they should be interested in the name Hitler? I placed my hands on my head and pushed downwards as if to force my brain to work. It made no sense at all.
Headache, said Brown sympathetically.
Sort of, I said, looking up, the kind that comes with complete confusion.
All you got to do is say everything you know. Leave it to us to be confused. Heck, that's our job.
That's funny, I said, surprised by the friendliness in his voice. I had sort of formed the opinion that you were Mr. Nasty.
Excuse me?
You know, the old interviewing technique, nice cop, nasty cop. I got it into my head that you were the nasty one.
Brown smiled bashfully.
Well, heck a mighty, son, he said in his cartoon Western accent. I kind of hoped we were both nice.
The door to the dining room opened, and Hubbard appeared.
Some people to see you, he said, stepping back from the doorway.
A middle-aged woman stood there for a moment, blinking in the light, and then rushed forward, arms outstretched.
"Mikey! Oh, Mikey, darling!"
I stared, open-mouthed. "Mother?" She ran towards me, bracelets clacking.
"Honey, we've been worried sick ever since we heard. Why didn't you call?"
My arms full of her, her soft powdered cheeks against mine, I let her complete the long embrace. Her hair was dyed a bright gold, and the scent of her was alien in its richness and deep-fruited perfume. But it was my mother, all right. No question about that. I looked up over her shoulder and saw a man limp slowly into the room.
"Christ," I whispered. "Father, is that you?"
The last time I had seen my father, I had been 10 years old. He had not been bald or frail or stooping. He had been strong and upright and handsome, and everything a dead father remains for all time in the memory of a child. He looked at me briefly. "Hello, son," he said, and then turned to Hubbard with a nod.
"You're sure, sir?" said Hubbard.
"Absolutely sure."
"You don't think I don't know my own boy?"
"Of course it's Mike," said my mother, stroking my hair. "What happened, honey? They said you were in an accident. Why didn't you call?"
Their accent sounded, to me, wholly American. I didn't want to speak and frighten them with my own British voice. I searched for words that would sound neutral in accent, words without too many R's or A's in them.
"My head," I said in a low whisper. "Bump." "Oh, my poor baby. Did you see a doctor?"
I nodded bravely.
"Mr. Hubbard,"
my father was saying, "maybe you would now be kind enough to explain to me why you thought this might not be my son, and why we were conveyed in the middle of the night by government car to a house like this, a house which has all the appearance to me of a—"
"Why don't we all sit down around the table and discuss this?" said Hubbard, and I thought I detected a hint of deference in his voice.
My mother was gazing tenderly into my eyes and still stroking my head, perhaps feeling for the bump.
"Hi, Mom," I said in the best American I could manage.
Mom seemed more likely than Mother, Mum, or Mummy. She smiled and shushed, leading me to the table like an ancient invalid. Brown, meanwhile, had returned from the adjoining kitchen with a larger coffee pot and a big round plate of biscuits. My father was wearing a severe frown and looked about him with mistrust.
"I assume, gentlemen," he said, "that there are listening devices planted in this room. I may well be retired from the services now, but you will know from my record that I have connections in Washington, in your department in Washington, Mr. Hubbard. I am happy to place on your covert tape my extreme displeasure at the outrageous way you are treating me and my family. What you think my son could have to offer you is a matter entirely beyond my comprehension."
"We would like to come to that, Colonel Young," said Hubbard, licking his lips nervously.
"Colonel Young?"
I looked at my father again. I thought I had discerned a suggestion of Britishness in his voice, but no more than that hint of English that lingered till the end in the voices of Cary Grant and Ray Milland, the sort of fruity drawl that also existed in the tones of grand, natural-born New Englanders. He looked ill and old, and I didn't think I would have known him from the photographs I had grown up with in my mother's house in Hampshire, or from the 8mm footage that she ran at Christmases, or when she felt low and unloved.
"First off," Hubbard continued, "I would like to ask you, sir, and you, ma'am, if the words Brunau, or Pertzel, or Hitler, or Auschwitz have any meaning for you?"
My father cocked an eye briefly at the ceiling.
"None whatever," he said with decision. "Mary?"
My mother shook her head apologetically. Hubbard tried again.
"I would like you to think very hard, Colonel. When you were still in England, perhaps, maybe you heard the names there,
"'I saw them written down. This is how they are spelled.' He opened his notebook and passed it over to my father, who looked at the words carefully. "'The ending "'au" is common enough in southern Germany and Austrian place names,' he said, with a thoughtful Holmesian dip of the head. "'Talgau, Turgau, Passau, and so on. I am not familiar with Brunau, however. Hitler means absolutely nothing, nor does Pölzl, I fear. Auschwitz could be northeastern German, Polish even. Mary?' He pushed the notebook past me and towards my mother. I noticed that my father had pronounced the German words flawlessly. My mother stared at the words as if willing them to mean something for my sake. "'I'm sorry,' she said. "'I never saw those words before in my life.' Hubbard took back the notebook and sighed. "'You are aware, no doubt,' said my father, "'that when I sought asylum here in 1958, I was thoroughly investigated.' My debriefing took more than a year and a half. Since that time, my work for the American government has earned me the highest commendations. I hope you are not now questioning my loyalty. "'No, sir,' said Hubbard, a pleading note in his voice. "'Not at all, I assure you, not at all. Please believe that. Well, then, perhaps you would now be finally kind enough to tell me what this is all about.' "'Mikey,' said Hubbard. "'Feel like doing me a favor?' "'What sort of favor?' "'A very simple one. "'How about you recite to me the Gettysburg Address?' "'I swallowed. "'I'm sorry?' "'Are you mad?' my father spluttered. "'The Gettysburg Address, Mikey,' said Hubbard, ignoring him. "'How does it go?' "'I racked my brains for a way out.' The Gettysburg Address. Something about 80 came into my mind, and I knew it contained that famous spiel about government of the people, for the people, and by the people, but that was all I did know. How the various parts connected up was a mystery to me. I had a dread feeling that the Gettysburg Address was one of those things that every American was supposed to know, like the words of the Star-Spangled Banner and the meaning of grade point average. "'Go on, honey,' my mother said encouragingly, "'like you used to. "'Michael has a lovely voice,' she added to the room. "'My memory is not so good,' I said huskily. "'You know, since—' "'That's okay, Mike,' said Hubbard. "'Matter of fact, you can read it if you like. "'It's up there on the wall, behind me. See?' Sure enough, above his head, framed in pale wood, was a long passage of text mounted on deckled cardboard, the opening word 80 in fancy block capitals. I knew that Hubbard was not interested in whether or not I had remembered the speech, but what my accent would sound like when I read it and what effect that would have on my parents. To hell with it, I thought, and began to read. I declaimed without pretense, without any effort at American vowels or cadences. Even to my own ears, after a day of hearing nothing but American voices all around me, I sounded more like Hugh Grant than anything human. But what the hell? 80 ago, I read, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add. Fine, said Hubbard. That'll do fine, Mike. Thank you. He turned to look at my mother, who was goggling at me as at a ghost. Mike, darling, she said, a hand to her mouth. Read it properly, like you used to, on 4th of July parades. Do it properly, honey.
I'm sorry, Mother, I said. That's how I sound. This is my voice. This is me. My father was staring at me, too.
Michael, he said, if this is your idea of a joke, then let me tell you.
No joke, sir, I said. It's no joke.
Hubbard, more relaxed now, switched on the recording box, and once more the conversation between me and Steve at the Alchemist and Barrister was broadcast to the room. My father frowned as the machine played. My mother shot anxious, uncomprehending glances between us.
Hitler Pulzel Brunau.
Hubbard switched off the recorder and repeated the words slowly.
You've told us, Colonel and Mrs. Young, that these names mean nothing to you. Judging by the conversation we have just heard, they mean a lot to your son, wouldn't you say?
My father pointed at the recorder.
Whose was the other voice we heard?
That was the voice of an undergraduate named Stephen Burns, a junior year history of science major. We have nothing against him other than that he is a suspected homosexual.
A homosexual?
My mother's eyes rounded in horror.
Is this what this is all about? Because let me assure you, Mr. Hubert...
That's Hubbard, ma'am.
Whatever your name is, let me assure you that my son is no homosexual. Absolutely not.
Of course not, Mrs. Young. Believe me, that is not what we wish to imply. It was what your son said that interests us. Hitler, Pulzel, Brunau.
You keep mentioning these names, snapped my father. What's so darned important about them? Isn't it clear that my son is sick? He needs medical attention, not this inquisition, this childish cloak and dagger nonsense.
You are still quite sure that he is your son?
Of course we're sure. Now, how many times do I have to tell you?
In spite of his accent?
Don't be ridiculous. We've told you. I would know Michael if he shaved his head, grew a beard, and spoke in nothing but Swahili.
Hubbard put up his hands.
Well, now you see that's what makes this whole affair so curious. Affair? Affair? What is this? The Lisbon incident? A boy bangs his head, loses his memory, and speaks in a strange accent. This is a matter for medical science, not paranoid midnight interrogations. Now,
my father started to rise.
If there is nothing further, we would like to take Michael home.
Brown, who had been pacing up and down behind Hubbard, leaned forward and whispered in his ear. Hubbard listened, whispered back a quick question, and then nodded his head. Something in their body language made me aware, with some surprise, that it was Brown who was the senior of the two.
"Colonel Young, sir," said Hubbard. "I'm afraid that isn't going to be possible just yet. I need you to sit down to listen to me." I believe I have listened quite enough.
It won't take long, sir. Perhaps Mrs. Young wouldn't mind waiting in the next room for a short while.
I am staying right here, said my mother, pink